Iranians hold nationwide rallies to condemn U.S. policies on the 43rd anniversary of the U.S. embassy takeover in Tehran. North Korea fires more ballistic missiles just as the U.S. is preparing to fly a B-1B bomber on the final day of air drills with the South. Plus, the Biden administration announces $400 million in additional military aid to Ukraine. Now, top story, Iranians have taken part in nationwide rallies to mark National Student Day, which is the anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979. The day is also dubbed the National Day Against Global Arrogance. Gisu Misha Ahmadi tells us more.
In more than 900 cities nationwide, Iranians from all walks of life took to the streets on Friday, November the 4th, to mark National Students' Day, the anniversary of the U.S. Embassy takeover, which is also called the National Day Against Global Arrogance. In the capital, Tehran, masses gathered in the streets leading to the building that used to be the U.S. Embassy in Iran before the Islamic Revolution. They chanted slogans expressing their anger and frustration with U.S. hostile policies towards the Islamic Republic of Iran.
We have come here to show our support for our leader in the face of enemies of our country, including the U.S.
Our presence today shows the U.S. that the nation is vigilant and we will not bow down to U.S. plots.
Considering the recent riots, it was even more important for me to take part in the rally this year. We have to show to the world that we love Iran and we support the Islamic Republic.
We are here and it's literally, we're coming onto the streets 43 years. You cannot find any more democratic country than Iran. What's the turnout of elections in Europe, in the West? There's supposed to be like the civilization and democracy, land of democracy. What's the turnout of their election? Look at all these people. These are coming by themselves.
Every year on the 13th day of the Iranian month of Aban, the Iranian nation, particularly students, hold rallies across the country to mark Students' Day. But this year's rallies come amid violent foreign-backed riots in the country, which have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces.
What's significant about this year's 13th of Aban or Students' Day demonstrations is the fact that you can see the younger generation taking part in masses to send their message to the world. In particular, you can see many young ladies taking part in this year's demonstration.
The U.S. should know that we have chosen to wear our hijab and no one can force us to take it off.
Our hijab is a symbol of our religion and our faith. Our country is an Islamic country and this is the way we choose to live.
In a statement, the demonstrators pledged allegiance to the Islamic Republic and the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. They also called on authorities to address people's legitimate demands and also draw a line between peaceful protesters and rioters. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iran's president has slammed his U.S. counterpart for supporting the recent riots in Iran and for vowing that Washington will free the country. President Ibrahim Raisi says Iran was freed 40 years ago in a reference to the Islamic Revolution of 1979.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
Raisi told the rally in Tehran to mark the National Day Against Global Arrogance that the Iranian people are resolute and will never allow the U.S. to achieve its, quote, satanic goals. The president says the U.S. has been involved in over 300 wars and 62 coups across the world under the pretext of liberating nations. He says, despite all that, Washington keeps trying to paint itself as a supporter of human rights. And Iran is also censuring the UN Security Council over its failure to condemn the recent terror attack in the country's southern city of Shiraz. In a letter to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the Security Council has been inexcusably silent on the Daesh claimed attack. The foreign minister says the council's silence shows some of its members continue to categorize terrorists into good and bad ones. Amir Abdullahian says such behavior, when coupled with discriminatory and irresponsible actions, make it more difficult for the council to effectively carry out its mandate in combating international terrorism. The terror operation in the city of Shiraz targeted pilgrims in a shrine, killing over a dozen people, including children. North Korea launches more ballistic missiles as the neighboring South conducts the last day of joint air drills with the U.S. on the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean military says the North fired four short-range missiles into the Western Sea. It says the projectiles flew with an altitude of 20 kilometers. The launch comes hours after the U.S. deployed two B-1B strategic bombers on the last day of joint air drills with South Korea. The drills were the largest ever by the two sides. Seoul and Washington say they were a response to provocations by Pyongyang. North Korea, however, says the drills are a rehearsal for an invasion. It has launched a series of missiles in protest this week, with one landing near the South's territorial waters. We spoke to our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, about the latest military muscle flexing around the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. had deployed its B-1B bomber to Anderson Air Force Base in Guam just a few weeks ago. And once things got out of hand in the eyes of the U.S., it decided to send it over here to the Korean Peninsula for the last day of these vigilant storm military drills, which are the most upsetting drills of all to North Korea because they involve stealth fighter jets like the F-35 that would take part in a preemptive strike on North Korea by the U.S. and South Korea. The U.S. finally decided to send the B-1B bomber over here to the Korean Peninsula, which is a nuclear stealth bomber. It's huge, much bigger than the F-35, and this would be used as a weapon to nuke North Korea in the event of a war accidentally breaking out here on the Korean Peninsula. So we will have to see what happens with these daily provocations and raising of tensions by both sides, by both North Korea and by the U.S. and South Korea on the other side. And there seems to be no end in sight. Neither side is willing to back down.
Turning elsewhere now, former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused the country's incumbent Premier Shehbaz Sharif of involvement in his assassination attempt. Khan said Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah and a senior army commander were also involved in the plot to kill him. He said two shooters tried to kill him in the Wazirabad city on Thursday, opening fire at a protest march he was leading to the capital, Islamabad. Khan made the remarks in a live speech from a hospital in Lahore, where he has been receiving treatment. The politician sustained a gunshot wound in his right leg in the attack. The shooting also left one person dead and nearly a dozen others wounded. Several leaders of Khan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party have blamed the government for the assassination attempt. Government officials have denied the allegation.
An attack on the convoy of ousted Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan wounded him and several of his supporters who were marching towards Islamabad, demanding early elections. Police said that a gunman opened fire at the campaign truck carrying Imran Khan, wounding him slightly. Since his ouster in a parliamentary no-confidence vote in April, Khan has been alleging that his dismissal was a conspiracy engineered by his successor Shehbaz Sharif and the United States. The PTI leadership has directly blamed Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a high-ranking military official for carrying out the assassination attempt.
We demand that these three men should be removed from their posts. If these people are not removed from their positions, then there will be nationwide protests.
While asking Imran Khan's supporters to stop the blame game, the government has assured every possible support for holding high-profile inquiry into the assassination attempt.
The incident is very unfortunate and condemnable, but it should not be politicized, and speculations on this incident must be avoided.
Political experts believe that the attack on the PTI party chief will trigger further political instability and chaos in the country.
I think in the days to come, the Pakistani political atmosphere will be more charged. It will be more violent. This gun attack on Khan will definitely change Pakistan's political scenario.
The attack on the former Pakistani premier also sparked countrywide protest and international condemnations.
The attack on the former Pakistani prime minister has further fueled the ongoing political tensions. It is highly believed that more confrontations would be witnessed in days to come in the country's political arena. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Turning now to India, where the capital, New Delhi, is struggling with hazardous air pollution causing a surge in respiratory illnesses among the city's 20 million inhabitants. The air quality index of New Delhi has been in the severe category for the last 3 days. Authorities have ordered primary schools to shut and other academic institutions to stop outdoor activities. A filthy smog forms over the city every winter. It is largely blamed on construction dust, vehicle emissions, and smoke from crop stubble burning in neighboring states. The Federal Pollution Control Board has banned the entry of diesel trucks carrying non-essential goods into the capital. Delhi's administration has also suspended most construction work. A study shows more than half of the people who die because of air pollution are younger than 70. The U.S. is stepping up its military aid to Ukraine by $400 million, despite warnings by Russia. The U.S. will pay for the overhaul of T-72 tanks and for missiles used in Hawk air defense systems. There is also funding to buy hundreds of tactical unmanned aerial systems and dozens of armored boats. The U.S. has been the biggest sponsor of the Ukrainian military since the beginning of its war with Russia in February. The value of the U.S. military aid now stands at close to $19 billion. Moscow has repeatedly warned against the delivery of foreign military aid to Ukraine, saying it will only prolong the conflict. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, says not only the U.S., but also other NATO countries are providing Ukraine with military aid and funding.
Britain, for example, giving over 6% of its military budget to Ukraine. Some Eastern European countries giving as much as 40% of their military budget to Ukraine. So this is very much a fight between Russia and NATO. And while NATO continue to arm Ukraine, it's Ukraine that is paying for this war in blood. Tens of thousands, probably over 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers have already been killed in this war. Much has been made of Russia's partial mobilization recently, but Ukraine is already on its third or fourth wave of mobilization. So very much at the moment, Ukraine giving Ukraine the weapons and Ukraine paying for it in blood. Moscow continues to warn of the same, of potential escalation. The United States has also said that there is now U.S. troops in Ukraine. We've known that for a long time. They say that they're training Ukrainian soldiers. But there's also a lot of speculation that particularly British and American military advisors may well be helping to coordinate Ukraine's fight on the battlefield. So this war continues, and Russia indeed continues to warn that this war is in danger of spilling from a regional war into a global war. And of course, a war between Russia and the United and NATO be catastrophic for the whole world.
Moody's has changed the Italian banking outlook from stable to negative. This as growth prospects in the country have been downgraded by national and international statistical agencies and institutions. Max Giavitti reports from Rome.
Rating agency Moody's has recently changed its ratings outlook on Italy's banking system from stable to negative. Business conditions for Italy's banks are expected to further worsen in the coming 12 to 18 months, especially with regard to the quality of their loans and earnings. The news broke at the heels of a series of downgrades in medium-term growth forecasts by the Bank of Italy, the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, Employers Association Confindustria and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development.
We will hold a highly important cabinet meeting on Friday, during which we will discuss new budgetary targets as the government is racing against time to draft the 2023 budget law.
Italy's statistical agency ISTAT has predicted that the Italian economy will be flat in 2023 after growth of around 3 to 3.5% this year. Moody's forecast was even more cautious, predicting 2.7% growth for this year as a whole and zero growth next year.
The challenges for Italy go well beyond economic growth. Prices have reached record highs lately, with the country's annual inflation rate hitting almost 12% in October and energy costs still out of control. In addition to that, the euro's weakness with respect to the American dollar has significantly eroded the purchasing power of the Italians.
Milk, bread, pasta, all these basic items cost much more now. I'm very worried.
When you go grocery shopping, but also when you buy fuel or are faced with paying exorbitant energy bills, everything seems to be out of control. That said, I am pretty sure that they are not telling us the truth about what's really going on.
On Thursday, Italy's new far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni travelled to Brussels to meet with the leaders of European Union institutions for the first time. In the Belgian capital, Meloni held two meetings with the President of the European Parliament, Roberta Metsola, and EU Commissioner for Economy, Paolo Gentiloni, in which her main ask was reportedly greater joint EU efforts to cope with energy costs. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. I've tried to sum this up in the title I gave to this lecture, Life-Giving Faith. A faith which works like an overflowing spring, a faith that is accompanied by duty, a faith that is a weight on the shoulders of the believer, a faith that is accompanied by action. When we read the Qur'an, we notice the phrase, those who have faith and do righteous deeds, repeatedly associates faith with good works. Faith alone, faith without duty, faith without any sense of responsibility, is of no use in this world and of no use in the hereafter. This is the Quran's logic. Our reading tomorrow will be on roughly the same topic, and the verses we will ponder on tomorrow, God willing, will illuminate this further so that there will be no doubt. Those who think that faith is something that resides only in the human heart believe that even if a person pays no attention to the duties this faith imposes on him or the demands it makes of him, they are still a believer. They imagine that one can be a believer through belief alone, without action, without effort, without struggle. They make the promises Allah has given to the faithful promises to almost everyone. They suppose that paradise is granted because of something in the heart, without any action to back it up, and that dominion over the earth is granted because of something in the heart rather than action.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In short, they imagine that if we put action to one side, something of faith still remains. But the people who believe this must read the verses and the tens of others which are found throughout the Quran, which make it clear that the faith that Islam values is a faith accompanied by action, by responsibility, and by duty. If you feel no sense of moral responsibility, then you should doubt whether you are in fact a believer. A society which does not act on the duties of faith cannot call itself a believing society. Those who hear the Quran's words, "Do not weaken or grieve, you shall have the upper hand should you be faithful." Those who hear this amazing reassurance from the Quran only to see that when they look at reality, those who believe in the Quran are no better than anyone else. In fact, they see that they are dependent on everyone else. They are going to wonder what happened to the Quran's promise. And if they do not find any time when this promise was fulfilled, they are going to await the appearance of the 12th Imam, ajjalallahu farajah.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Nigeria recently discovered an illegal connection line from one of its major oil export terminals into the sea that had been operating undetected for 9 years. Now, this oil-rich West African nation loses billions of dollars monthly due to theft of oil. The country's navy says major oil multinationals are complicit in this theft. The head of Nigeria's state oil company, NNPC, Mele Kyari, speaks during an operation that uncovered the illegal oil connection.
What you are saying is yes. That the private contractors,
yes.
Surveillance contractors, must be aware of this. The GSS around here should have known about it.
Yes.
Shell supervisors should know about it. That's the point you are making.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on massive oil theft in Nigeria, one of the major crude oil producers in the world. The country's navy says multinational oil companies are part of the syndicates in the crude oil theft in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. In the second part of our program, we shall be looking at the issue of the Herero-Nama genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia during the colonial era. Opposition parties in Namibia have rejected the compensation deal offered by Germany and want it renegotiated. Our experts today will give us their incisive analysis of these topics, and you can be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Multinationals stealing Nigeria's oil. Early October, officials in Nigeria discovered an illegal connection line from one of its major oil export terminals into the sea that had been operating undetected for 9 years. The head of Nigeria State Oil Company, Mele Kyari, said the 4-kilometer connection line from the Forcados export terminal, which typically exports around 250,000 barrels per day of oil into the sea, was found during a clampdown on oil theft.
The Nigerian Navy has meanwhile accused international oil companies of being involved in this massive crude oil theft. While to discuss the rampant theft of Nigeria's crude oil and its impact on the country, we have contacted Don DeBer, an activist and commentator. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Now, the Nigerian Navy has reportedly accused multinational oil companies of being involved in the massive theft of the country's crude oil. Now, what's your take on these accusations?
You know, the word theft may be a loaded term, but clearly the people of Nigeria are having their oil stolen by whatever mechanisms, whether it's legal or not. Now, President Muhammadu Buhari last year did a clean sweep of the military officers, the top military officials. And the Navy in particular has gotten itself involved in trying to deal with this. One of the things that he did also, though, was reconstruct the National Oil Company there, in essence privatizing it into something that is really bewildering to decide, you know, to try to determine who owns what. And there certainly is an awful lot of room for shenanigans at the moment because it's not transparent.
President Muhammad Buhari has on several occasions expressed outrage over large-scale crude oil theft, saying it was affecting the country's revenues enormously. Buhari has instructed security agencies, especially the military, to speedily clamp down on those involved in oil theft in the Niger Delta.
I also wish to reiterate that we will not allow a few criminals to have unfettered access to the nation's crude oil supply. Hence, I have directed our security agencies to speedily bring to a halt the activities of these vandals in the Niger Delta. Recent activities on our seas, where large vessels seek to hide in neighboring countries, will be checked.
Nigerian Chief of Naval Staff, Vice Admiral Awal Gambo, says the military is determined to ensure that oil theft and pipeline vandalism were contained. Oil theft in Nigeria has been going on for decades. Experts have expressed doubt over the ability of the country's security forces to effectively end this theft that is posing an existential threat to Nigeria's oil industry.
Nigeria, like almost every nation state on the African continent, is wrapped up in this network of military command and control that has the Pentagon at the center. We've said that we know that 40% of the oil out of Nigeria is coming to the United States. One can assume that some of that or some additional figure is going to the United States illegally. We only have to look at Syria, for example, where the U.S. is illegally occupying a portion of that country. Which portion? The portion where the oil reserves are. You can look at Libya, which was demolished in order to steal the oil reserves. And also, by the way, to remove Libya as an example of what an African country or any country can do to uplift its people using the oil reserves. So, you know, it's difficult to know, first of all, what the intentions are of the people that President Buhari just placed at the command of the military, including the Navy. Second, the hard thing to know is what they can actually accomplish if they actually intend to do something about it in that environment.
The Nigerian National Petroleum Oil Company says it loses $700 million every month as a result of oil theft and vandalism at terminals. United Nations agencies have been urged to designate Nigerian stolen crude oil as blood oil. Now, the loss of oil revenue endangers the achievement of UN's Sustainable Development Goals in Nigeria, the most populous country in West Africa. Now, what is the immediate and long-term impact of this oil theft on Nigeria?
Well, okay. So, you know, on the one hand, the GDP of Nigeria is, I forget what, where, somewhere 2 or 3 trillion. It's very large because of the vast amount of petroleum products that are being shipped out. That's a large part of it anyway. $700 million a month, that works out to about $8.4 billion a year. The simple arithmetic, right? You know, to me, it's a simple management problem. With $8.4 billion a year, you could hire, say, all those guys at the airports in the United States that check your shoes to see if it has any, you know, shoe bombs in it or whatever, post people with guns and some of that fancy equipment at the, you know, at a post near each of these points where the oil was literally leaking out the door, and tighten the security. And out of the $8.4 billion, you probably still have $8 billion left over after paying for that. So that could be done. You know, although $8.4 billion seems like a small amount next to, say, $2 or $3 trillion, like, you know, 3 or 4 tenths of a percent. On the other hand, $8.4 billion out of 225 million people is something like $4,000 for every man, woman, and child in Nigeria. And looking again at the HDI numbers there, and for the income numbers there, that would make a huge impact on the, you know, on the situation of the people in Nigeria.
Stolen Nigerian crude is sold in the international market, after which the proceeds are laundered through world financial centers in Western countries, especially Britain and the United States. Clearly, the pillaging of African resources by Western colonials is going on unabated.
For example, Congo has been on fire since 1960 in the aftermath of the Bandung, you know, the beginning of the non-aligned movement in the early 1950s and the anti-colonial movement that saw governments, you know, throw off the colonial powers and try to, you know, stand on their own. Patrice Lumumba in Congo, for example, was murdered and chopped into little pieces and made to disappear. Again, as an example to others who might think that way in Africa and Asia and elsewhere. There's, you know, the United States is bigger and scarier now than it ever was on the one hand. But on the other hand, the potential to throw this colonial relations off already has never been greater. The people are, around the world are starting to hold hands. You can see in terms of oil, for example, the budding relationship between Iran and Venezuela. And also with OPEC plus one or two or three or whatever, standing in solidarity with Russia.
There are 5 major international oil companies present in Nigeria: Chevron, Eni, ExxonMobil, Shell, and Total Energies. Some of these companies face accusations of complicity in the country's oil theft. The people of Nigeria are fed up and now want action taken. Recently, members of the Petroleum and Natural Gas Senior Staff Association of Nigeria staged rallies over rising cases of crude oil theft.
We are borrowing and putting our children and generations yet unborn in perpetual slavery and in perpetual debt. So we felt that as a nation, we should rise up, and as an association, we should stand to be counted and our voice needed to be heard.
Now, our last question. Isn't it about time that oil multinationals in Nigeria are compelled to account for their crimes? Should they go scot-free while They are stealing billions of dollars from Nigeria every year while the masses in the country languish in poverty.
You know, right now we're looking at Haiti, for example, being invaded again. I made reference before. And again, just to strike the point, on the Human Development Index, Nigeria is one notch below Haiti. Haiti has been punished since 1803, basically, by the West for having the temerity to overthrow the slave masters and to massacre them and claim their independence. It drove a shockwave through the slaveholding world at the time. It was the first slave rebellion that was successful against the European colonial order in the world. And in many people's minds around the world, it still stands as an example. You know, the proximity of the condition of the Nigerian people to that of the people of Haiti on that, Human Development Index list may be inciting some ideas in the minds of people who have been trying for generations now to find peaceful solutions to their condition to be thwarted over and over again by Europe and the United States in particular.
Well, there you have it. The theft of oil in countries such as Nigeria can come to an end if there is firm resolve to stop the looting. I'd like to thank our guest, Don DeBar, for his insight. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on compensation for the Herero Nama genocide perpetrated by Germany in Namibia during the colonial era. Stay with us.
Namibian opposition want genocide compensation renegotiated.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Tens of thousands of men, women, and children were shot, tortured, or driven into the Kalahari Desert to starve by German troops between 1904 and 1908 after the Herero and Nama tribes rebelled against colonial rule in what was then named German Southwest Africa and is now Namibia.
A descendant of the victims gives a glimpse of what transpired during the genocide.
My great grandmother used to tell us how people were killed by the Germans and cooked to feed pigs.
Recently, Germany agreed to pay Namibia 1.1 billion euros as compensation after it officially recognized the Herero Nama genocide. The government in Germany says the payment is a gesture of reconciliation, but not legally binding reparations.
Namibia's largest opposition party has rejected the deal. Popular Democratic Movement party leader Mark Henry Venani has called on Germany to renegotiate the agreement it struck with Windhoek, admitting its role in the genocide during its rule of this Southern African nation. Venani says he is ready to work with the government to get a better deal from Germany.
We are ready to play a meaningful dialogue with you as brothers and sisters. So the German authority must come to the party and play a meaningful role in resolving this dialogue. To that end, I have invited the leader of opposition, the CDU leader, Chairman Merz, to come to Namibia. We have lost enough, and we must get a quantum that speaks to the loss that we have lost. And we are ready to play a meaningful dialogue with you as brothers and sisters. So the German authority must come to the party and play a meaningful role in resolving this dialogue.
Now to discuss the protracted struggle for the compensation of the Namibia genocide perpetrated by Germany, we have contacted Nestor Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thank you for your time today. Now, is the opposition in Namibia justified in rejecting the 1.1 billion euro compensation deal offered by Germany for compensation of the colonial era Herero and Nama genocide?
So this is a pretty complicated issue. I guess some people might be able to look at it as the politics, internal politics of Namibia, where the National Unity Democratic Organization, which is part of the National Assembly, is positioning itself, or at least, positioning itself in the politics of Namibia, juxtaposed to SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, the ruling party. But then it's also a question of the people in Namibia being divided in some ways around this issue. They really were not, as far as they're concerned, included in the negotiations between Germany and the governments between Germany and Namibian government.
On the 2nd of October 1904, colonizers from Germany issued an order for the extermination of the Herero and Nama people, including women and children. Namibians were machine-gunned and their wells poisoned. Those who survived were either driven into the Kalahari or Namib deserts to die, or taken to the concentration camps, such as Shark Island, as prisoners of war. At such camps, they started illegal experiments on the prisoners. This was a horrendous crime committed against the people of Namibia by Germany. Namibians have rejected the current 1.1 billion euro compensation offered by Germany as an insult and want an acceptable deal.
Leaders from the Nama and Herero communities in Namibia say former colonial ruler Germany is not doing enough to make up for the genocide it committed there in the early 20th century. Esther Mwenjangue of the National Unity Democratic Organization is one of the leaders calling for a renegotiation of the genocide compensation deal.
Germany has been dictating. And for me, it was like a case of you have a murderer or a rapist, and this person is the one to decide whether I have raped or not, and should I find myself guilty, what could be the best punishment or verdict that I can give myself? So that is how the whole process was not acceptable to us.
Now, what is the option left for Namibians if Germany refuses to renegotiate the compensation deal?
I mean, I don't know. I think the options for Namibians if Germany refuses really are up to how organized they can be and how unified they can be, and putting ultimatums to Germany. Also, not just among the Namibia, but also looking at it in terms of the continental unity aspect of Africa. Africa is plagued by, the ravages of neoliberalism and neocolonialism that really can only be withstood by a unified Africa. And so right now, Germany is in a position to really be able to, to refuse things and not really suffer any kind of consequences. And so, with the organization of the masses in Namibia and elsewhere, then there can be consequences, and there should be consequences if they refuse.
The Herero and Nama genocide was the first genocide of the 20th century. Yet Germany offered a half-hearted apology under pressure from Namibians. This conditional apology has been rejected by descendants of the victims.
I couldn't care less about apologies. We are demanding what was taken from us. What was taken from us? Our cattle, our livelihoods, our land. The land that the Germans took from us, they did not take it in a back with to Germany. It's still here. Their children are sitting on our land.
Germany has arrogantly stated that its apology cannot be a legal basis for reparations for the genocide. For many Namibians, such an apology is unacceptable.
this is not the first time that we see your colonial powers refusing to offer apologies to Africans and other non-European, non-white peoples when it comes to their colonization and their genocidal acts against us. And I think the central reason is the same for all of them. To offer, it's one thing to give reparations. It could be seen in the eyes of many as just aid and trying to help give a leg up to the less advantaged people. But to actually acknowledge that you are responsible for something as heinous as the crimes of humanity that colonialism has with all kinds of massacres, then it's also to begin to go down the slippery slope of having to acknowledge the responsibility of the current conditions of Africa. It's also just a racist, I would call it, psychological, like for now we refer to like cognitive dissonance. It speaks to, it would be a reflection of, or a it would be a reflection of what you call delegitimizing their notions of superiority.
We have seen Germany's compensation for the so-called Holocaust survivors amounting to billions of dollars. Now, recently, Germany even paid $662 million to aid Holocaust survivors during the COVID-19 pandemic. This amount is half of what is being paid as full compensation for the monumental Namibia genocide. Now, this is clearly a racist approach in compensation and reparations. Apparently, black lives don't matter for the German government. Do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree that black lives don't matter for any of the Western European powers, particularly those the ruling classes of those countries, those that belong to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We can see its crimes today across the planet. Don't demonstrate that they don't really care about the lives of any non-white people, and so anything they profess, the claims to do so, it's really just public relations ploys. And so that the contradictions and the double standards when it comes to providing aid and different reparations and things like that to other peoples is small in comparison in terms of what reveals the fact that they don't care. Black lives don't matter to them. They never did. And this is a question of power.
Well, there you have it. Western powers really don't care about black lives and the refusal by Germany to pay reparations for the Herero and Nama people of Namibia is a classic example. I'd like to thank our guest, Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace, for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the proofs that we can say confirm the authenticity and divinity of the Holy Quran. This is something from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and not man. Okay, what are your proofs for that, Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that we have plenty of reasons and arguments that Noble Quran is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And actually it is a glorious noble Quran, divine revelation by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the hearts of noble Prophet Muhammad. Each and every sentences and, you know, even letters of noble Quran are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and divine. There is no alteration occurred in the verses of noble Quran, no omission and no addition in the verses of noble Quran. And of course, we have plenty of reasons for that. But I ask my dear listeners to go directly to the Noble Quran and have a look at it.
Yes.
I think by studying and reciting the verses of Noble Quran, everybody can easily understand that these words cannot be man-made. Mm-hmm. Please, in the beginning, have a comparison between the verses of Noble Quran and many other novels, I don't know, man-made, writings and books. Have a little comparison between these two, books. Easily you come to this conclusion that these divine verses of Noble Quran are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and are divine, not man-made.
That's right.
In the verses of Noble Quran, for example, we have that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that وَلَوْ كَانَ مَنْ عِنْدَ غَيْرِ اللَّهِ لَوَجَدُوا فِيهِ اخْتِلَافًا كَثِيرًا. If it was not from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you could not find a lot of discrepancy in the verses of Noble Quran.
Yes.
And you know that it is one of the proofs that verses of Noble Quran are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and are divine.
Right.
You know that if you go to the man-made writing, you could find a lot of discrepancies, a lot of differences, you know. And of course, it is natural for human being to have these kind of flaws and deficiencies.
Yes.
But if you go to the verses of Noble Quran, you cannot find even single discrepancy and differences between verses of Noble Quran.
That's right.
You know that many verses of Noble Quran talking about the, different, about variety of issues.
Mm-hmm.
About this world, about hereafter. Inshallah, gradually I will go to this issue and I will touch upon this issue. But you cannot find single discrepancy in the verses of Noble Quran.
Right.
We have many examples that have been mentioned about the verses of Noble Quran, but I want to say that generally speaking, if you go deep into the verses of Noble Quran and have a look at these verses of Noble Quran profoundly, you could not find single discrepancy within it.
And so many harmonies are found in the Holy Quran, even among the numbers. For example, two important terms, men and women, rajul and emra, are equal in the Holy Quran. Each of them are repeated 24 times, okay?
Yes.
Sometimes you could find this balance and these miracles of the Holy Quran, even in the letters and the surah numbers and this and that topic, are really fascinating.
Yes, exactly.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
I think the main reason that some people believe that Quran was man-made is because we do not have clear understanding about the mechanism of the concept of wahy or revelation, okay?
Yes.
So if we want to prove that Quran is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through wahy, how we can answer such questions?
You know that first of all, if because it is one of the a question regarded to be considered to be from the Quranic studies,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yes.
There is a branch of science or studies which we call it Quranic studies. And many scholars, they have talked about this issue.
Yes.
One of the best reasoning for that is the meaning of tawatur, of the verse of Noble Quran, which means the frequently narrated verses of Noble Quran. You see that Muslim generation by generations, they narrated the verses of Noble Quran and they transfer it to different generation, beginning from the time of Noble Prophet Muhammad to the, you know, that this contemporary era.
Yes.
And Muslims, all of them, they have a great regard for safeguarding the verses of Noble Quran.
That's right.
If you look, if you go to the history, you can find a lot of evidences for mm-hmm. that.
Yes.
And of course, it has been narrated frequently by different generations from the time of the Noble Prophet to this contemporary era.
That's
and
right.
It is one of the you know, best maybe arguments for that these verses of Noble Quran actually are revelation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
Muslim, they were ascribing verses of Noble Quran, writing down the verses,
yes.
you know, on different pieces of the, you know, whatever was existed in that time.
Mm.
Some of them, they were from among the Qurra and Hamalatul Quran, Huffadul Quran. They were reciting the reciters of the verses of Noble Quran. They memorized, many of them memorized the verses of Noble Quran. And as I said, that they were a special group, they were writing down the verses of Noble Quran. So I want to say that generally speaking, it was a great emphasis.
That's right.
And actually, it was a kind of culture among Muslim generation by generation to safeguard the verses of Noble Quran and keep it and transfer it to the next generation.
That's right.
Till the contemporary era. So by this huge, you know, emphasis of all Muslim to safeguard the verses of Noble Quran, we can easily, you know, come to this understanding that these verses are from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed to the heart of Noble Prophet Muhammad.
That's all right. And this is not, the, as you mentioned, the Quranic studies, you know, but also the other monotheistic religions have proven the historical facts that are about their religion in the Holy Quran. That's why, for example, when we can say that's all right. The ambassador of Prophet Muhammad to Abyssinia, to Habasha, was sent, Ja'far, I think, isn't
yeah.
it? Was sent over there, and the king over there was a Christian. He first asked about
exactly
Prophet Jesus Christ and Lady Maryam mm-hmm. in the Holy Quran. And when the ayahs were read out to that man, to the king of that era, he in fact permitted them to stay over there. And the kuffar and the policies of the Mecca were not successful in jailing them. This shows that also the other religions have proved some of the historical facts and the verses of the and the ayahs of the Holy Quran, which are available in the Holy Quran. And this is not only limited to the Muslim scholars, for example.
Exactly. And more than that, let me add to your nice statement that you know that in history of the verses of Noble Quran, you find that sometimes maybe some Muslim, they want to omit one waw
mm-hmm.
from the verses of
yes.
Noble Quran. I do not want to go to that history. But you know that it was a huge turmoil among Muslims, and they did not permit that individual to omit the even vav, single letter,
yes,
from the verse of Noble Quran.
That's right.
Because, as I said, there was a great emphasis among Muslims to safeguard the verse of Noble Quran and transfer it to the next generation.
Yes.
And, of course, we have many other evidences for this issue.
That's right.